Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. We're going to start off by talking about the top 10 astronomy stories of the year 2006 with Jim Lattice, director of UW-Madison Space Place and faculty associate in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy. UW Space Place is located at 2300 South Park Street in the Villager Mall, and you can get information about what it is and their activities at spaceplace.wisc.edu. And Jim Lattice, thanks very much for coming in today.
Well, thanks, Jim. It's great to be here, as always.
I guess our timing was impeccable. You did a public talk last night on the stories that you considered the top astronomy stories in the past year, and now you're ready to talk about it today.
Sure. We can explore the list a little bit if you like.
Before we get to the list, let me invite you to join the conversation if you have questions about the stories that Jim unveils here in Madison. The local number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. And before we go to the list, there is quite a stir going on in your circles because of this comet that is visible just this week. And give us some details about that.
Right. It's called Comet McNaught. And McNaught is actually a quite prolific comet discoverer. He's got, I don't know, at least a half dozen comets. But this one was discovered last year in 2006 and has gotten a lot brighter than we expected it would. Comets are notoriously unpredictable anyway. So this comet has gotten quite bright and is easy to spot in our evening sky. So, but it's moving fast. In fact, this comet has an orbit that is bringing it almost directly perpendicular through the solar system. So it's coming in from the north, and it's going to pass by the sun and go out to the south. And once it passes by to the south, we northerners won't see it very well. Now, maybe in South Africa or somewhere they'll have some good views of it, but we're going to lose it by the end of this week. So the next few days are the time to go out in the early evening, right after sunset, probably between 5 and 5:15 might be about the best time, and to look into the southwest. And the sun will be going down in sort of the south-southwest, and a little bit to the left of where the sun goes down, you'll spot Venus, which is coming up and getting brighter in our evening skies this month.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit to the right of where the sun goes down, further north along the horizon, but still in the southwest, we should see the comet. And it's going to only be about five-ish, depending on exactly when you look, about 5 degrees above the horizon, which is very low. If you stretch your fist out at arm's length, your fist is only about 10 degrees high. So you can check and see whether you're even close. And most 10 degrees is a lot less than it seems. Almost anything on the horizon will sub 10 degrees. So you need to find a location where you have a clear view off. So people on, say, the east side of Madison's lakes would have a great view looking, you know, westward across the lakes. If you're out in Blue Mountains or something, you know, if you're on an elevated location where you've got a view to the southwest, that's what you want to look for.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've only got a short time before it will set. The comet itself will set by, I think, around 5:30 or so.
So if you're sitting in a lake, Trout Lake at Boulder Junction, you should be looking again southwest?
Southwest. Look southwest for the comet. It's quite bright and should be easy to pick out. Don't confuse it with Venus, which is further south, that is roughly to the left of where the sun goes down and has no tail. And this comet has a very visible tail.
And so at this point, it could be extremely bright. It could be faintly bright.
It's pretty bright. It stands out quite well from, I mean, that's still pretty bright twilight between 5 and 5:15. The sky is still noticeably blue, and the comet stands out pretty well. I haven't seen it. I failed to catch it last night. It's also visible before dawn. Shortly before dawn, you have even less of a window before dawn to see it. It's very low on the horizon, but because it's north of the sun, it goes down after the sun and comes up before the sun right now, just for a few days here. So I haven't seen it personally myself. I've seen a couple of pictures. I saw one picture last night just taken here locally, and it's quite impressive.
Our guest is Jim Lattice. He is the director of UW-Madison Space Place. And we're now going to talk about the top 10 astronomy stories of the year 2006. And Mercury pops up in your number 10 story.
Right. I listed events that were not only of general interest, but things that we were able to observe here in Madison. And I thought the best of those sorts of things, of the visible events, was the transit of Mercury. Transits of Mercury are relatively rare. We get 13 or 14 of them per century. So, you know, every 8 years or so. But then typically they happen when it's nighttime for us. Not typically, but sometimes they're going to happen when it's nighttime for us, and sometimes they're clouded out. And that actually happened to the last two transits of Mercury before this one. So the one that we saw on the 8th of November was the first transit of Mercury we'd seen in a while, and it was quite a nice sight. We set up telescopes down at Space Place and watched Mercury cross in front of the sun, which is really cool.
This wasn't noticeable with a naked eye.
No, Mercury is very small, and so in addition to the problem of looking directly at the sun, where you'd have to use a filter or something, but even if you had used a solar filter, you wouldn't be able to pick out Mercury without a telescope. But that's in contrast, though, and this is a good time to mention the transits of Venus, which are much, much rarer, but we have one coming up in 2012, and a transit of Venus, some may remember the one from 2004, the 2012 transit that's coming up, you'll be able to see Venus without a telescope, just with an appropriate solar filter so that you can look at the sun. And Venus is quite large on the surface of the sun. And then we won't have another transit of Venus for like 150 years.
And when will the next transit of Mercury occur? The
next Mercury transit is, I think, 2016 or something like that. Do I have that here? I believe it's quite some years away.
I think you're right. 2016, and Venus is going to be in 2012.
There you go, yeah.
So that is the number 10 story on the list of top 10 astronomy stories of 2006. And anywhere along the line, if you have a question about these stories, you can call us in Madison at 263-1890, or it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. How about story number 9?
Well, my number 9 pick was, a lot of people would probably rank this higher, so was the story of the reclassification of Pluto as no longer a planet. And this, of course, received quite a lot of press in late August, early September. The International Astronomical Union met late in August, and they had before them some proposals for how to define planets. And so everybody knew there was going to be some kind of a change, because there was no formal definition of a planet before. So once you have a strict definition, then all of a sudden you're going to have categories and things are going to fall in or out. And one possibility that was before them was actually to expand the number of planets. So Pluto wouldn't have changed, and we would have gotten extras that would meet the definition, which includes the properties that it has to an object has to orbit the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, these definitions apply only to the solar system. Nope, we're finding planets around other stars, and they're being really careful not to try to make definitions about those things, because we don't know really what's going to merge in there. It has to orbit the sun, and it has to be big enough. There's an awful lot of stuff orbiting the sun. So the way to distinguish the bigger things from the smaller things is to say, well, it has to be big enough that its shape is spherical. That means that there's enough mass in the object to deform the all the materials in it into a roughly spherical shape. By that definition, we would now have not only the 9 planets that we all know, but 3 additional ones. One of the asteroids in the asteroid belt, of which there are thousands, is big enough to be spherical. It's called Ceres. And then there's the object which is sometimes called Pluto's moon. It's really sort of a companion, called Charon. It's big enough to be spherical. And then a newly discovered object now named Eris. It was known for a little while as by the name Xena, informally as after the television character,
after
which the astronomer,
character, yes.
Yeah, who discovered it as a fan. Those 3 objects would have counted as planets by the definition that looked like it was going to be adopted. But then at the last minute, the International Astronomical Union introduced a new criterion, and that was that the object must have enough gravitational influence to have cleared out, which is kind of a non-technical term, to have cleared out the other objects in its orbit. And by that definition, Pluto hasn't done it, because there are a lot of objects out there in the near vicinity of Pluto's orbit. Ceres in the asteroid belt certainly hasn't done it. There are lots of asteroids around there. So those objects can't be planets by that definition. Neither can Eris, for the same reason as Pluto, because there's lots of objects out in what we call the Kuiper belt out there now. By that definition kicked Pluto out, and so that's why we now have only 8 planets by this now definition of the word planet. And so Pluto now falls in a category that we call dwarf planets. So Eris, Ceres, and Pluto are dwarf planets.
Are the three dwarf planets?
Mm-hmm.
What did you think personally as an astronomer for some long time now about Pluto and its demotion?
Well, the real problem is that there hasn't been a good definition of the word planet, and I suspect my gut feeling is that they probably should have left it that way and not have created a technical definition for the word planet. These traditional words like moon, star, planet emerged in a very non-technical sort of context, and probably it would have been better to invent a new term or something rather than to try to define this traditional term planet. But really, I thought it's really an indicator of our increasing understanding of what's happening. Now that we have the knowledge to make distinctions, that tells us that tells you that scientists are now able to categorize these kinds of things with much greater precision than we could. So it's really an indicator of growth in the field and an indicator of our growing understanding of the structure and nature of the solar system.
Jim Lattice is our guest. He's the director of UW-Madison Space Place and is a faculty associate in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open for you. You can get on rather quickly at 263-1890 in Madison or at 800-642-1234. And we move on to number 8 in our list of stories, and that involves Venus.
Yes, my number 8 pick was something truly important. And I should say that my ranking here is, you know, pretty
highly arbitrary.
Something like that. This is truly important because the Venus Express spacecraft arrived successfully at Venus and went into orbit around Venus on, I think it was April 11th. And we haven't had a spacecraft studying our nearest neighbor planet for quite some time. Mars gets a lot of attention, and for very good reasons. But Venus is very important scientifically as well, for any number of reasons. Understanding why Venus is the way it is could give us a lot more insight into what we might do to the Earth, what climate changes might happen on the Earth, and the evolution of the Earth, how it got to be the way it is, because Venus evolved in a very different sort of direction, but from very similar starting points to the Earth. So having a spacecraft there is important, and understanding especially the atmosphere, which is what the Venus Express is going to focus on. But it also started producing results immediately. On the day after it was in its working orbit on the 12th, it discovered atmospheric structures at the south pole of Venus that were unknown before, in particular sort of a double vortex that's happening at the south pole of Venus. And understanding that will be a major task now for planetary, for atmospheric scientists who study Venus.
And the super rotation of atmosphere?
Oh, yeah. It turns out that the atmosphere on Venus rotates very slowly. And you would expect normally that the atmosphere of a planet would go along with the bulk of the planet. That's what happens here on Earth. The atmosphere as a whole moves along. There are, of course, winds and currents right. And things like that. But on the average, the atmosphere moves along with the rotation of the Earth. But on Venus, that's not the case. The bulk atmosphere moves faster than the planet. And it's hard to understand what could be driving that. And again, that's a clue that there's things happening in the dynamics of the atmosphere that that need explaining. And so they'll be working on that. That was yet another finding.
Our first three stories in our top 10 astronomy stories of 2006, they include the transit of Mercury, the reclassification of Pluto as a planet, and the Venus Express reaching Venus and now sending back images for scientists to pore over. And we'll get to the rest of this list. Take your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us this morning as we talk about space and the top 10 astronomy stories of 2006, along with an alert about a comet that's passing through this week, the C. McNaught. More about that coming up. And we'll take your calls in a moment. There are a couple of lines open in case you would like a question answered. 263-1890 in Madison, toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. Before we go to Jim in Jackson, let's talk about a couple of things that you're involved with. First off, the Star Stories program at the UW Arboretum McKay Center. When will that be held?
That will be this Saturday, the 13th. Saturday the 13th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. And the Arboretum is doing the an evening of activities at the McKay Center. We'll be contributing a Star Stories, or participating in, I should say, a Star Stories program there at the Arboretum. And if the sky is clear, we'll be setting up telescopes and doing some sky viewing as well. So that's open to the public, of course. And we've done this for the past few years. It's always a lot of fun.
And you've got your annual Space Place Telescope Clinic also this month.
Right. Speaking of things that we've been doing for some years, we've had probably 12 years now, I guess, we've been doing the telescope fair every the fourth Tuesday in every January. And we invite anyone with a telescope to bring it down to Space Place. Yeah, sorry. Anyone with a telescope to bring it down to Space Place, and they can get help setting it up, getting it ready to observe. So if you got a new telescope for Christmas, or even if you just had a telescope sitting around for a little while and need a little help getting it set up. A lot of people need help with the finders and eyepiece selection and the mounting setups and things like that. And that's what we do. So we just open up from 6:30 until 8:30 on Tuesday, January 23rd, and you walk in with your telescope, or you can walk in without a telescope because we set up our own and we have models of most typical telescopes. So we can talk about how you would set up yours if you can identify one that's similar to it, or just look at other people's telescopes. It's a lot of fun.
And again, if people want a schedule of activities, they go to your website.
Right, which is spaceplace.wisc.edu.
And to Jim in Jackson. Jim, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I'd like to know if he could comment with regard to the expansion of the universe. What's the smallest scale that expansion has been detected?
Let's see. Yeah, I can comment on that, although I can't tell you specifically what the smallest scale is. But I know that, for example, between our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, and the Andromeda galaxy, the expansion of the universe is overcome by the gravitational interaction of those two galaxies. So along with several other local galaxies, but our Milky Way and the Andromeda galaxy being the largest of what's called the local group, that group is bound together by gravity, and the expansion of the universe is not spreading that group out. So gravity at those distances, gravity overcomes the expansion, the cosmological expansion. And in fact, the Andromeda galaxy and our galaxy are approaching each other and will eventually collide and merge into a much larger galaxy, and that's like 5 billion years down the road or something. So at least over that scale, the cosmological expansion is less influential than gravity. Over distances between galaxy clusters, it begins to be significant.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Jim, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. And Vincent's in Racine. And Vincent, what's on your mind today?
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I have a question about space dust. We often hear about space dust, and I've never heard anybody explain the chemical composition. Are they iron particles or calcium carbonate or silicates or what?
Well, depends on where you go get it. There is dust in space. There's what astronomers call interstellar dust, which has a range of compositions. There's also what we would call dust in the solar system, which has a different sort of category. So it would depend on exactly what you're talking about. In fact, one of the objects on my list, should we jump ahead?
Yeah.
On my list, number four on my list is the return of comet dust from an actual comet, that is a spacecraft called Stardust, that was sent out to fly through the tail of a comet called Comet Vilt 2 actually, collected samples and brought those samples back to Earth. And that's the first pristine samples that we've ever had of cometary dust, of comet material. And in that particular case, it presented some puzzles. Comets are predominantly icy bodies, and the formation of comets, we thought, early in the solar system, must have involved the icy, the volatile materials farther out in the solar system. But this comet dust tells us that comets have also incorporated material that formed much closer into the sun, material like minerals that we would find here on Earth, for example, olivine, for example, crystals like that, which are called refractory, that you only find in the high temperature parts of the solar system. So the process of comet formation early in the solar system involved some kind of mixing between the inner and outer solar system that was previously unsuspected. So we have a lot to learn about cosmic dust still.
Vincent,
does that help?
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your inquiry, and we appreciate your call. Our number in Madison is 263-1890, or it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. We'll get to a couple more calls in a moment, but let's go back to your list of the top 10 astronomy stories of 2006. And what is story number 7?
I think on 7, I listed the solution of a long-standing astronomical puzzle, which is the cause of a certain type of event called a gamma ray burst, which have been known for 40 or so years. But until fairly recently, it was a great puzzle just what was causing gamma ray bursts. Now, these are can only be observed from space, and it was the reason that we've known about them for 40 years is that was when satellites that were capable of detecting these things were first put in orbit. And in the last few years, it turns out the gamma ray bursts fall into a couple of categories, basically short and long. You have the ones that can go for hours to days, and the ones that only go for a couple of seconds or less. They seem to fall in these two categories. The long bursts, we're almost certain now, are caused by explosions of very massive stars, usually at great distances from our galaxy, and so probably taking place at an earlier stage of the universe's evolution when very massive stars were more common. But the short gamma ray bursts remained a puzzle, and this year results were published that make it pretty certain that short gamma ray bursts, but only pretty certain. There could be other theories that will come along, but the current theory, the popular theory, I'll put it that way now, is that neutron stars in binary systems eventually collide with each other. This takes a very long time for this to happen, but when a neutron star is disrupted, basically broken open like an egg by a collision with another neutron star, they release tremendous energies for a very short time. Something like 100 million times the sun's output in the period of a few tenths of a second. And an event like that doesn't leave the same surrounding cloud of material that a supernova does. And so the energy is released all at once and then dissipates almost instantly, whereas a large cloud of debris from a supernova explosion continues to glow for hours and days. So that seems to be the distinction between the two kinds of gamma ray bursts, and this is the first time we can say that we have now a good theory for why the short ones happen.
Let's get in number 6 before we go to the phone.
Sure. Number 6 is that this year, a couple of interesting things happened with our study of planets beyond our solar system. What we typically call exoplanets is a popular term for that. Exoplanets, we now know more than 200, and that number, that threshold, 200, was crossed during the year. But that's not the most important thing. But during the year, an exoplanet that has very low mass was discovered. The lowest so far known is only about 5 times the mass of the Earth, and that's pretty small. Now, that would be a biggish planet in our solar system, but not big enough to be a gas giant in all likelihood. And so the chances are that this planet is actually a rocky, icy planet like the Earth, but scaled up. And the particularly interesting thing is that it orbits an M-class star, which is essentially a red dwarf star, a very common sort of star. So if red dwarf stars, which are the most common stars in the galaxy, can have planets, that certainly suggests that planetary systems may be easily as common, maybe more common than we even thought before, and many of the planets in those systems may be Earth-like planets. So that was interesting news.
It certainly is. Let's go to the phones and take some callers. Anita's been waiting patiently. Anita, thank you. And what's on your mind today?
Hi there. I have an almost 5-year-old who really enjoys reading about the solar system, and, well, not reading. I read to him. But the question I have is, are there places in Wisconsin that have planetariums sort of geared to kids, it would be a good place to take them to see the stars at night, or they have programs? I'm new to all this, and he really likes it so much, I'd love to take him so he could look through a telescope and things like that.
Right, and that's a great thing to do is to get them interested when they're young. I would say that, by the way, that it's very hard for little kids to learn to use a telescope. Five is about the time when they begin to be able to see anything through an eyepiece. I'm not sure what it is, but there's much younger kids look in an eyepiece and they don't actually see anything for some reason, for the most part. Well, but you can give it a try. It's about time. And if you have access to the best planetarium in the state, and the newest is in Milwaukee at the Milwaukee Public Museum. And I can't tell you whether they have a specific program for kids, but certainly they have programs there. There's also a planetarium in Madison. The Madison Memorial High School has a program, and he does a public program there on Friday nights, but you should really check their website. I'm not sure what his schedule is. I know there's a planetarium at the UW Eau Claire, and I think they do public programs, but again, I couldn't tell you what their schedule is. The latter two are smaller ones, the one in Madison and the one in Eau Claire, and might be more likely to do sky programs where they point out constellations and things like that. I don't know that they don't do that at Milwaukee, but I know that they in Milwaukee they're featuring sort of pretty fancy programs that present, you know, fancy graphics and things like that. I don't know if they're doing sky programs where they point out constellations or not, but that would be a good question for them. Other than that, those are the only planetariums I can think of off the top of my head. If Chicago is a possibility for you, then the Adler Planetarium just can't be beat. That's probably the best in the world, only in competition with maybe New York City for a planetarium opportunity.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
All right, Anita, good luck to you. And let's go to Mickey in Lake Geneva. Hello, Mickey.
Hello there. How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
Love your show. I'm glad that we have a show for astronomers or amateurs or wannabes.
Great. Thanks.
Okay. My question here to you is the structure of galaxies, i.e. the black holes being present at the creation of galaxies.
Okay.
And can you comment on that, please? Because I just saw this the other night on a TV program.
Well,
Geographic.
Right. And what you're talking about there is that it seems that most, maybe all, large galaxies have a very massive central black hole. Ours certainly does. The Milky Way galaxy has a black hole at the center of it with a mass of millions of times the sun. So it's a very massive black hole. But some galaxies have much more massive black holes than that at their centers. And one of the interesting things is that the mass of the black hole seems to scale with the mass of the galaxy. That is, the larger the galaxy, the more mass of the galaxy, the more mass of the black hole. And that is a little bit curious because, for the most part, most of the mass in the galaxy doesn't interact with that black hole. They're almost like they gravitationally interact, but it's not like there's matter constantly being dumped into the black hole at the center of a galaxy. In fact, for the most part, in mature galaxies in our epoch of the universe, we don't really see the black holes doing very much at all. And so the question is, where does this linkage arrive? How does the black hole have a mass that's somehow proportional to the mass of the galaxy? And that suggests that there's some relationship early in the formation stage of galaxies in which they do evolve in tandem, and so the more mass that's available, the bigger both of them get. But what mechanism that is that links those two, we don't know. So it's a very intriguing clue that probably is telling us something about galaxy evolution, but we don't know the answer to that yet.
What about the rotation rate of galaxies? It seems like the outer portion of the galaxy rotates at the same rate as the inner. Do I have my facts incorrect?
It depends on the type of galaxy and the part of the galaxy that you're talking about. In a galaxy like our own, we could distinguish the inner part of the galaxy, the nucleus of the galaxy, from the disk of the galaxy. What we often call the bulge is sort of the nucleus, which is redder and more amorphous and has a particular population of stars that tend to be older. And the disk stars tend to be younger and spread out into this thin disk shape. In the disk, the stars are orbiting around around the center of mass of the galaxy. And so in a smaller orbit, they orbit faster, just like Mercury goes around the sun faster. And the more distant stars, like the sun is like two-thirds of the way out, orbits slower. It takes us about 200 million years to make one orbit around the center of the galaxy. So there's if you think of that as a rotation, there's a differential rotation. It goes faster towards the inside of the disk and slower towards the outside of the disk. But the bulge rotates as a rigid body, as if it were a rigid body. That is to say, the entire bulge rotates as a together. So this is yet something, again, how this situation evolves, probably comes from mergers of other galaxies, is a major question in galaxy evolution.
Mickey, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate hearing from you. The number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's 800-642-1234. Talking with Jim Lattice, director of UW-Madison's Space Place at 2300 South Park Street in the Villager Mall, about the top 10 astronomy stories of the year 2006. We started with the transit of Mercury, then the reclassification of Pluto as a planet, the Venus Express reaching Venus, neutron star collisions, gamma ray burst the cause. Now we've got the exoplanets, and coming down to story number 5, and that would be a tie.
Right.
You couldn't make up your mind. So right. What stories do we have for 5?
Well, I'll just toss those out, too. One is that, in fact, this comes back to the galaxy structure question that we were just talking about. Understanding our own galaxy has made enormous leaps and bounds just in the last couple of years. Including understanding that part of the galaxy, that bulge part of the galaxy, which includes a bar. The bulge in our galaxy is a bar-like structure rather than being more globe-like. And the nature and dimensions of that bar in our galaxy were more accurately measured this year, in fact, by some UW scientists working on that. But the other thing that I just couldn't resist keeping on the list was the better understanding of something else local, which is an ancient piece of astronomical equipment that was plucked out of the ocean about 100 years ago that was built by Greek astronomers in probably about 100 BC or somewhere in that period, and is a very sophisticated piece of equipment. It's a remarkable, both technically for its construction, for its accurate construction, but also for what it tells us about astronomical theories that they were using at the time. We know about those from written sources, and here we have an actual example of a mechanism designed to reproduce the motions of the sun, moon, and maybe the planets. So by using a modern CT scanner, they were able to dissect the innards of this thing, which is almost a corroded mass of rock almost at this point after spending a couple of thousand years on the bottom of the Mediterranean. But that news came out that we better understand the structure of this and better understand the history of our own understanding of human understanding of astronomy. So I had to get that on the list, too.
And number 4, we referred to earlier the comet dust studies showing the solar system formation to be very complex. And let's get number 3. And what would that be?
Number 3, there was, and this is truly an interesting thing. Everyone's heard of dark matter, probably by now, that there are forms of matter not like normal matter in the universe. And there are various ways of attempting to detect and map the presence of dark matter. And the most dramatic of these emerged in the year 2006, which was a situation in which two galaxy clusters have collided. And something interesting happens. Galaxy clusters are pervaded by a lot of gas. There's a huge hydrogen gas cloud in which the galaxies orbit around the center mass of the whole cluster. And when two galaxy clusters collide, one of the main effects is that all that gas is heated into to incandescence, and we can detect the glow of the gases in these galaxy clusters. But the interesting thing is that the dark matter, when these two clouds collide, the dark matter just sort of passes of each cluster pass through each other and don't slow down, because dark matter doesn't collide and interact in the electromagnetic way that normal matter does. So in the case of this galaxy collision, where two galaxy clusters have passed through one another, the gas basically slowed down and glowed and is closer to the center of the point of collision, and the dark matter has passed on through and is now out to the edges. And so this collision has differentiated the normal matter from the dark matter. And the dark matter, was mapped by looking at even more distant galaxies behind this galaxy cluster and looking to see how it distorts the light, what astronomers call gravitational lensing.
Mm-hmm.
So the lensing reveals the dark matter, and the glowing hot gas reveals itself. And what we see there between the distribution of the lensing and the hot gas is a difference between the distribution of the normal matter and the dark matter. And that's the first time that's ever been so dramatically demonstrated. So that was my pick for number three.
Nick in Madison, why don't we give you a chance here? Go ahead.
Two quick questions. I've been reading Bill Bryson's book, Short History of Nearly Everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking for other books to read that are more geared towards a layman. And also your open house later this month. We don't have a telescope, but are looking to buy one. Good time to come and look at them.
Yes, certainly. If you just come down to Space Place, that's one of the things that we're expecting, is that we'll just show off telescopes and talk about what you have in mind and what might be appropriate for your for what you've got in mind. So please do. As far as book recommendations, there's such a wide variety out there that it's hard to recommend. If you're particularly interested, I've often recommended Terence Dickinson's Night Watch if you want to get into stargazing, because it's a nice mixture of hints for actual stargazing and information about the astronomical objects that you will then see when you start to observe. So that's where I would suggest that one place at least that you could start.
And story number two turns out to be involving Mars.
Mars, and also one of the moons of Saturn, Enceladus, both of which showed evidence during the year of water very close to the surface. We've known that Mars has water on it somewhere, but it turns out we saw evidence of actual water flowing on the surface of a crater of Mars. And on Enceladus, this moon of Saturn, it has water volcanoes that are spraying water out into space.
Let's go to Ambrosia in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I was fascinated for years about what's going on in Switzerland and Geneva, and I think they're going to turn a switch on this year about the tunnel, about racing head-on collision, about looking for some matters which is unknown to us.
Right.
Do you know anything about it? I think it's a pretty expensive thing. It's going on for a long time.
Right. In generalities, yeah, the super collider will be able to achieve energies that have only been happened in the... that haven't happened since the early evolution of the universe. And so they hope to explore the physics that might have happened around the time of the Big Bang with something like that. So that's going to be very interesting to see what starts coming out of that. And I think you're right. They're just about to test that device.
And story number one from the year 2006.
Story number one was the first ever landing on an asteroid. The Japanese managed to land a spacecraft on an asteroid and take remarkably up-close pictures of it. And asteroids are intriguing and dangerous to us. It's better that we understand them better.
All right. And as we close, let's just reference once more the C. McNaught comet.
Right. And what we want to do is see it either shortly before dawn or shortly after sunset in the southwest or the southeast at dawn. So about 5:15, look in the southwest, and there'll be two objects right after sunset, two bright objects, Venus more to the left and the comet with a fairly bright nucleus and tail to the right.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jim. We appreciate your having been here today and putting together the Astronomical Top 10 of 2006.
My pleasure, as always.
And if you'd like a CD copy of the program, you can purchase it through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.